you'll help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, and after that moment of silence, we'll pray together the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Hey, everybody. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jay Kimball. Hey, everybody. We're here because Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I've asked a couple of friends from my home group back in Augusta, Georgia, to read the steps. Satcher's going to read the 12 steps, and Roscoe's going to read the 12 traditions.
My name's Satcher Adams. I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs.
My name is Roscoe. I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Number 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Number 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Number 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Number 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy should be based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
All right. You know, lots of times at these kind of things, you get to you pick the speaker up at the airport, right, and you whisk him back over here. You got maybe 15 or 20 minutes to get to know something about him and have to come up here and say something eloquent about him. That's not the case tonight. I I get to talk to this guy just about every day. I've read every word in the entire big book with this fella, done everything that it says to do. This guy is an example of, like, what the spiritual basis of life looks like. I had an old man years ago who walked me through the big book for the first time, and I didn't think that I would ever run across somebody else that I was able to connect with the way I connected with that old man, and I've been able to do that over the last year or so with this fella. And just a fantastic example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to take up any more of his time. Y'all give a big gratitude retreat. Welcome to Brandon.
Sound good? I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brandon. And before I get started, I've actually been part of putting together retreats and conferences multiple times, and it's not an easy thing to do. It's especially not easy to do, I would imagine, because I've never done it in the middle of a pandemic. But if we could just Let's real quick acknowledge the committee and all the members on it that made this thing possible, please. And any chance you get to thank one of those members, please do it, because it's selfless work. It's difficult. There's a lot of coordination. There's a lot of things that have to happen in order to make these things happen. It's fun for me to get to be the Thursday night speaker because I don't have to speak to as many people. And I get to get my talk out of the way. The biggest thing for me was to make sure I made it here. I appreciate my wife putting up with my stress of trying to plan to get out the door on time to make it here with plenty of time for me to go shopping for the belt that I forgot and get a little bit of time to relax and be present and get in this moment. You see, because in the big book, it talks about vision work. It talks about creating a vision for our day. It talks about creating a vision of what we want out of life. In the conduct inventory, it talks about our ideals, creating an ideal and trying to live up to them. And then the 10th step talks about every day is the day I must carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. I would challenge you this weekend, as we're at the beginning, to create a vision of what you want out of the weekend. Create a vision of what you're trying to hope and accomplish and connect with. Maybe it's reconnect with some friends. Maybe it's hear some things, get excited about God again, learn some things about the big book. I don't know what it is that you're here for. You probably do. Some of us didn't travel very far. Some of us traveled a long way just to get here. We came in all sorts of cars or planes or however we got here. We all got here to embark on whatever this weekend's supposed to be. So take a moment and reflect on what it is that you're trying to accomplish here, what you're trying to envision for your life. What things do you want to change? I'm going to read something out of another book. I do a ton of 11-step work and 11-step reading. And this reading is called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open. If only by chance, you must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like a bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss it. if you're always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it is easy to seize it. When you act, however, you must in turn have no shadow. In other words, you must leave no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. That is one of the ways in which you avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every moment is traceless. So we're at the precipice of an opportunity to expand our understanding of what it is that we're supposed to be doing here in this existence, doing here in this room, doing here this weekend. I am an alcoholic that I qualify for the long form of the third tradition. As most of you know, there's a long form and a short form to all of the traditions, and the long form has different requirements than the short form. The short form says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. However, our long form says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. I will share a couple stories with you that will prove to you that I do indeed suffer from alcoholism. That when I start, at certain times, I can't control the amount I take. And when I'm stopped, I can't stay stopped. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Another requirement, I have to want to get well to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. I'm also a believer in the fact that it's fascinating to me, really. When Bill in the first 100 wrote this book and they had the ability to it's just so fascinating to me. They had the ability at that time to pick any of the words in the English language, any of them, and they picked these. These were the words they picked. So this sentence in the foreword of the first edition is something that I believe. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, just for fun, I went in my old home group. We had a 1935 dictionary, a 1939 dictionary, and we looked up the definition of precisely back in 1935 and 39 just to make sure that it didn't say something different. And what it said was the definition of precisely was exactly conforming to in usage or rule. So kind of sounds like precisely now, right? So to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So I from the very first time I went through the steps, my sponsor took me through the book, and he showed me how to take another gentleman through this book to have them gain access to a spiritual experience. Now, going back to qualify, I usually like to tell a couple stories, but I'll also read this because this kind of gives you the basis of where I'm going to go. On page 29, it says, each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way in which he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership, and it is and a clear-cut idea of what actually happened in their lives. So, sounds like I'm here to testify for God. I think, personally, that this weekend is simply a pep rally for God. And for us to all get excited about whatever that power is that's currently working in our life and keeping us sober, whether we know it or not. So, years ago, my sobriety date is June 15, 2011. That was not the date I picked. That was the date that was thrust upon me by the universe through a really strange set of circumstances. AA did not get me sober. An experience that thrust me into an opportunity where a small window opened up that I call God's grace created this confusion in my existence to where I considered the possibility that perhaps I had a drinking problem. 2 weeks later, I ran into an old friend that no longer showed up at the parties that I was going to and asked him if he was still being good, and he wanted me to ask him what that meant. And I said, well, are you still not drinking? And he said, well, no, I'm not drinking. And I said, okay, do you go to meetings for that? And he said, actually, I do. And I said, well, would you take me to a meeting? And he said, sure, there's one today at noon. And I was like, no, I'm not. Not yet. He said, well, there's another one tomorrow at noon. I'm like, he said, in fact, there's one every day at noon except for on Sunday. We could go to a Friday night one. So I negotiated terms to go to his home group on Monday night. It was pretty awesome. We met his sponsor before the meeting, and he handed me a copy of a third edition book, and I'm like, what's this? And he goes, that's our book. I was like, you guys got a book? He's like, yeah, it actually contains the steps and explains how to work the steps. And I was like, oh. And then I went to that first meeting, and they were passing around the newcomer packet where everybody's putting their phone numbers on it. And I thought it was roll. So I tried to sign in, and then my buddy's like, no, that's for you. And I'm like, I know, I'm signing in. And he's like, no, just give it to me. All right. Anyway, so rewind to the past a little bit. So I had a wonderful, for a period of time, I was working in Austin, Texas, and I was, my family was still living in Atlanta, and I would fly home on Friday morning. I would spend the weekend with them, and I would fly back to Austin, Texas on Sunday evenings. This particular Sunday, because I flew every other week, I got upgraded to first class. And so I don't know about you guys, but if I get upgraded to first class, I have one mission. Okay, and that is to consume whatever they're willing to give me, and as much of it as I can, as fast as I can, in that 2-hour flight back to Austin, Texas. Right. Well, this particular day it was screwdrivers. Right. And so I ordered a screwdriver and drank it, and ordered another and drank it, and ordered another and drank it, and eventually, I got to a point where I ordered another one, and the flight attendant came up to me and said, "I'm sorry, I can't give you one." I'm like, I'm getting ready to argue with her because I'm like, I'm not that drunk, right? And she goes, "No, we're getting ready to land." Oh, so I'm not sure exactly the moment that I realized that I had actually flown to San Antonio instead of to Austin. Now, that's what my ticket said, and that's where my car was parked, but because of the way that the flights worked out and the price of them is sometimes I'd fly to Austin, sometimes I'd fly to San Antonio and drive back. And I guess as I was, killing the mini cart of the plane, I was I had forgotten that I was headed to San Antonio, okay? So this became apparent that it was a problem when I was walking to my car with my rollerboard bag behind me, and it wouldn't stay up straight. I mean, the thing kept getting all squirrely and kind of just falling to its side. The wheels must have been broken on it or something. I don't know what it was, but I'm sure if like there were tracks in the snow, it would have looked a lot like this, kind of back and forth, right? So I got to the car, and I realized in that moment, okay, so I'm probably pretty drunk right now. So we've got three options. So option one is I could sleep it off in the car, and, you know, when I felt less impaired, I could then drive home. Option two was I could get a hotel and sleep it off and then return to Austin the next day. And then option three was to find a place that was still selling vodka and orange juice at that hour and drink the rest of the way back, because I was already drunk enough to get a DUI. Might as well, like, do it up, right? So which one did I pick? That's right. So that night, I don't know, sometime in the middle of the morning, with every light on in the house, the big screen TV turned up to 100 with some less than desirable programming on the TV. I attempted to stand and realized that was not going to work, and also realized that I was getting ready to redecorate the living room with some fluid from the internal part of my body, and decided to crawl to the restroom. I had to go around that chair and then down the hallway, and proceeded to pray to that, you know, porcelain god that I had, and houses in Texas, they usually have tile floors kind of throughout, and I'll tell you, like, it's really comfortable to just, you know, you kind of nestle that cheek onto that tile and just really just settle in, right? So at some point in time, I think my jaw was getting sore, so I tried to pull the towel, you know, down to have a pillow, and the towel bar came off the wall and hit me in the head. And then that night, or the next morning, I woke up, and luckily I was the only one working in the office at that time, and I moseyed into the office, turned on my computer around probably 11:30, 12, to start my workday, and realized I couldn't really function, so I went home and took a nap, and then came back later that evening and attempted to work again, and it was the first time I looked, I kind of wondered if maybe there was a problem, and so I looked up some AA meetings, and I found one that was at a church that my family and I were going to join, that my son was going to go to preschool at. I just thought it was a bad idea for me to go to an AA meeting at the church that I was getting ready to join, because they might think I was an alcoholic. And I proceeded to drink for 4 more years after that. Okay. A series of incidents happened that struck me sober. I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't my choice. I had an evening where I was, there were plenty of times where I didn't want to exist anymore, right? I didn't want to be here anymore. But there was always that concern of, like, the judgment of others, right? The fear of what might happen to me if I actually killed myself, plus what would happen to my kids. And mostly it was, you know, I was worried about what you guys would think about me. But I had an evening in June 2011 where that didn't matter anymore. I was done. I was ready to move on. There was nothing keeping me in this existence. I didn't care what you thought. I didn't care about my kids. I didn't want to exist anymore. I stood outside the room where I kept my pistol, and the decision was made. There was no contemplation of should I do this, should I not do this. It was done, right? It was simply a matter of just doing it. And so my dog at the time was with me, and she had no idea what was going on. She just kind of lay on the floor, and I'm standing outside this room where the pistol is, just getting drunker and drunker and drunker, figuring at some point in time I'd be drunk enough to actually go in and do it. It's like there was a force field on the door, and I couldn't go in. Well, I don't know exactly what happened, but my wife was out with some friends at the time, and she was going to come home, and if she was going to come home and I was this drunk, then that would require a conversation and explanation, and I didn't want to be there. So I took the kids over to a neighbor's house. The kids went to bed there, and I drove an hour to my parents' house and attempted to get into their house, and there was this strange key that nobody really knows what it was for that I tried to use to get into the back door of their house, and it wouldn't work. And so I had taken my dog with me because I was worried about pulling off the side of the highway and hitting a bridge or something like that. And I figured if she was with me, then at least I would make it the rest of the way. And so she and I passed out, fell asleep on the the back patio with some patio cushions and some towels, and woke up the next morning with my dad bumping me with his foot, wondering what the hell I was doing on his back patio. And in that moment, I realized the fatal error. I didn't have a good story. So I asked him if he would go back inside, because I needed to come up with a story, right? And so he acknowledged and went inside, and this is the way I describe it, but guys, this does not do what happened justice, right? In that moment, the sun was brighter, the birds were louder, and the air was crisper, and the magnitude of what had almost happened the night before came down upon me, and I knew it had something to do with alcohol, and I knew I didn't want to go back to that place ever again. And so the fear of that sobered me up for exactly 4 days. And 4 days later, right back at it. You see, because I'm a guy that I can't just play the tape through. I can't just think. I need an experience with God that just forces me into this place where I have no other option, right? And so I'm kind of a smart ass, so my God's kind of a smart ass, right? And so here's kind of what I think happened is God said, you know, I let you live through the night, and you're back at it. Here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to take away your house, your car, your kids, your wife, your job, everything that you thought was important, and then maybe you'll pay attention. So within 2 weeks, I'm on an island with no bridge off the coast of South Carolina, and in the middle of that week, on Wednesday, my wife announces to me and to her parents that she no longer wants to be married to me. And in that moment, house, wife, car, kids, everything that I thought was important, everything, all of the material things that I thought I had built my life for were ripped from me. And then from Wednesday to Saturday, I got to listen to my wife and her family tell me what was wrong with me. It was an excellent start to a 6-step defect list. And I vowed over the course of those several days that I was going to return to work and I was going to make so much damn money that she was going to regret the day that she ever left me. See, I love it when I'm talking to sponsees and they have a plan, right? Okay. So, Sunday night, getting ready to, you know, restart my week. And I'm having one of those weepy, snotty cries, you know, that if you've ever been on a 12-step call, it's kind of like that. Where I'm doing that, can't catch your breath, and she's in the guest room, and I'm in the master bedroom in this huge bed all by myself, and the dog doesn't even want to be with me, right? And it's like, what are you doing, dude? And gets up and leaves. And I say probably the most perfect prayer I've ever said in my entire life, which is, God, I don't even know if you exist or not. But if you can, just make it better. Just make it better. And so a sense of calm came over me. In that moment, I climbed back up into bed, went to sleep, woke up the next morning. I was energized, came back from vacation. I was ready to go tackle that job and go make all that money. Got to work on Monday morning, and they fired me. So here I am, a complete failure at living, a complete failure at dying, right? Everything that I ever thought, Brandon's plan was failing miserably, right? And it was suggested on that trip by my mother-in-law that perhaps I had a drinking problem. Now, I didn't really believe her, but she advised me to go back and look at the... We went onto this island with no bridge and no store, and she brought for a week, she brought me an 18-pack of Bud Light and a 6-pack of Corona. And I'm like looking at that going, or it was a 12-pack of Corona. I was looking at that going, what are you guys going to drink? And when can we go back over to the island and get some more, right? But before I left, you know, God works in mysterious ways. The night before we left, I had gone to a party in the neighborhood, and they had a keg, and they were pouring sake in the keg beer and calling it fortified. So, seems like a good idea. And we didn't have any limes, right? But we did have some absolute citron. So, if I just take the absolute citron and pour it into the Coronas, it's kind of like a lime, right? So that's what I did. I only had 6 Coronas. There was probably about that much left of the vodka, though. So there were these things that started happening to me where I started to existence started to open up to the possibility that maybe there was something else going on, right? Like I didn't really believe in God, but I didn't really not believe in God, right? I was kind of, well, it was really inconvenient to believe in God, really. Because if all that stuff that they said, you know, like you're going to, if you do this, then that's going to happen and so on and so forth. Like if that's true, then like we got some problems, right? So, when I started attending meetings, I audited the AA program for about 42 days, gathering information. Right, I was going to go on my kayak trip, and you know, if you've ever been kayaking, well, you have to drink while you're kayaking, right? And see, I'm not kidding. People laugh at this. Maybe you will too. Is I thought when you joined AA, that was it. Like, you could never drink again. I really didn't know relapse was a thing. I was ignorant to so many things, right? Maybe there's a God. I don't know. So I was going to wait to join until after the kayak trip, right? But again, I got a pretty funny God, and God had this funny way of having me have this spiritual experience that I really wanted to share with somebody. And so I really wanted to share it at a meeting. But if I shared it at a meeting, then I was going to have to actually admit I was an alcoholic. And I'm not ready to join yet, right? But I really want to share, right? And so I started sharing. And you know, a couple of the defects God has not chosen to remove from me is I like to be the center of attention, and I like to feel important and make it sound like I know what I'm talking about. And well, if those defects had been fully removed, you might have a different speaker tonight. So I shared this experience, but when I was on my way home from that meeting, the thing, like, this thought, this ever-present thought was with me is, well, if I was wrong about that, what else have I been wrong about? And this new experience of life opened up, right? Because I don't need to know everything, right? And so I got a sponsor that, you know, met my qualifications, and he started kind of fumbling me through the book and passing along an experience. And about 90 days in, I went to a retreat, a much smaller room than this. It's only about 60, maximum 60 people that could attend the retreat. It was at a monastery. You know how you go to some meetings and there's like a handful of people where you look at them and they're having a different experience with life, right? The lights are on. There's something different going on in their existence from the rest of the meeting, right? 3, 4, 5, you know, people. And then there's the rest of the people, right? And so, you know, because I am who I am, I was, you know, always judging those people, trying to figure out what is it that they're doing different, right? They're probably not really alcoholics. They already had money. They already had wives, right? But I go to this retreat, and I walk into this room, and there's a room full of people where they're having that experience with life. And the lights are on for them, and they're excited about life, right? And so I continue to assess them. And the thing that I realized is that they had all actually worked the steps. And the majority of them had worked the steps out of the big book, as outlined, with a competent sponsor. So I promptly fired my other sponsor and got a new one. And then he took me. He had 30 days less sobriety than I did, but he was 5 steps ahead of me. So he was already in step 6. And his sponsor suggested that he get busy sponsoring because, you know, the book says that the greatest protection we have against another drink is working with another alcoholic. And he was a bad one. So his sponsor told him to get sponsoring right away. And so he started taking me through the steps. And at some point in time, he decided, he came to the conclusion that he was not alcoholic. He just liked to smoke marijuana, and so he was probably okay doing that. And he did that for 4 years until Taco Tuesday, and maybe I'll talk about that, I don't know. So I've since had the opportunity of taking that man through the steps. I've also had the opportunity of taking that first gentleman that I asked to take me through the steps. I took him through at 35 years sober, and I only had like 3 or 4. And he had an experience with God, a new experience with God. Because, you know, it talks about this in the second step. It's the second step proposition. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? I like to change that. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself that could take me beyond where I currently am in any aspect of my life? Because that power loves me so much more than I could possibly imagine and have a new experience. And it's that willingness and open-mindedness that I've carried with me all through my sobriety. I've had some bumps in the road. I've had some struggles. But for the most part, this thing that people talk about, this pink cloud thing, I call it God's grace, and it's never left. It has never left for me. I'm as excited about God, if not more excited, than the first day that I started having an experience with it. And the thing that excites me even more than anything is transmitting that experience to another guy. I love the way that the feedback I get that explains how the world views me. Recently, a sponsee told me he's in a sober living, and his house manager said, "Yeah, that guy's really weird, but he seems to have good luck with taking guys through the steps and them staying sober." I said, "Tell him thank you." That probably maybe would have offended me in the past, but not anymore. Because I am. Because, one of the things that I've learned is that the hardest part of trusting God is... Well, actually trusting God. And when you actually do that, and you actually have that experience with whatever that power is for you, you look a little weird. And people start to kind of question if you're a little bit sane sometimes. And that's okay. Because if you do this work, and you redo this work, and you redo this work, and you explore the spiritual path in multiple ways, what ends up happening is you start to realize that you're actually who you are. and that you can't be anybody else. In fact, if you're being somebody else, you're actually failing. And it is my experience that when I get real with who I am, the thing I realize is that there's a whole lot of people that aren't going to like me. There's a bunch of people that are going to like me a lot. There's some that are going to not like me a little bit. Some that are going to only like me a little bit. And an even larger majority that really don't give a shit about me one way or the other. And I love what I heard one time as a guy said, he said, you know, how much time do you actually spend thinking about yourself? And, you know, everybody asks that question too. They always go conservative or like, you know, like, I don't know, like 50% of the time. I'm like, oh, that's weird. I think about myself about 90% of the time. And if I think about myself 90% of the time, then what is everybody else doing? So if that's the case, they're probably not paying a whole lot of attention to me, right? But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few minutes. Book says few hours. Doesn't take that long for me. I tell one or two stories. Might take me 15, 20 seconds. I got somebody nodding their head. We're connected, right? Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Now, I used to read that differently. I used to read it that the ex-problem drinker who has found a solution and is properly armed with facts of himself can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished, meaning until I actually gain the confidence of another alcoholic. I read it differently today. Today I read it that until I'm properly armed with facts about myself, I can't win the confidence of another alcoholic. You see, I've got enough inventory that I've written with the same thing showing up again and again and again. Name changes, face changes, I show up the same way. You know, and I can't work on my defects. I can't make them go away. You know what it sounds like when defects are getting removed? I've harmed you, and I would like to make things right with you. As I make my amends to other people, and I make numerous amends for being an asshole, you know what I start to realize? Might actually be one. Now, God uses that from time to time, but what I find is that when I hear that internal dialogue, for me, like, prayer and meditation is so incredible because what it's done is it's separated my thoughts. Is my thoughts, I don't know, be fun to explore, but my thoughts come in from the right side. They come in over here, and when I'm looking at those thoughts, the more I'm praying and meditating, the more I'm refining that signal from whatever that power is I have the ability to decipher thoughts as they come in. And I can actually play with, if they were little file folders, I can play in different file folders while having a conversation with you of where am I going to go next? What are we going to talk about? Now, before, like, I was talking to a sponsee the other day on the phone, and I was explaining how I was piecing together parts of existence to come up with this little clue of, oh, this is what's going to happen. And he's like, wow, do you always think like that? And I'm like, oh, yeah. And he's like, does that hurt? And I'm like, it used to. And so I had to drink to slow all that stuff down so that I could actually function, right? But when I start meditating, what happens is I start to have this ability to decipher the thoughts in a clearer way. And I have two consecutive thoughts that come at the two concurrent thoughts that come at the same time. But one of them's kind of quiet, and it always comes first. And then I have a louder voice that really desires being heard that comes split second later. Okay. I like to call that second louder voice the thinking mind, the one that tells me how important I am and what you need to know about me, right? And if I forget to listen to the quiet voice, you might actually get the same voice back, right? I'm really important. But if I listen to that quiet voice, sometimes it says, here you go again, buddy, thinking you're pretty important, don't you? And I pause. And then I have the ability to decipher things. And I have the ability to not lash out and not harm people with that louder voice. Right? Rarely have we seen a person thoroughly follow our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not give themselves just a tiny bit to the simple program. You see, because if I look at how I used to live, is the amount of time that I spent either getting drunk, recovering from being drunk, or thinking about being drunk, it left me a good solid 3 hours a day where none of those things were happening. You know, standard day, wake up in the morning feeling all cruddy, drink a pot of coffee, stop at the gas station on the way to work, down a couple Dr. Peppers, maybe eat a couple donuts, gotta settle that stomach down, right? Get to work, make another pot of coffee, wander around, catch up with everybody, see how their day was. Maybe around 10 o'clock, fire that thing up and actually get some work done, right? Well, probably around 11:30, I'm starting to get hungry and the stomach's a little unsettled, and so I got to start rounding some people up for lunch, right? Maybe we leave a little bit early. That way, if we stay gone a little bit longer, nobody will notice that we actually took a longer lunch than we were supposed to. You know, come back from lunch, maybe 1:30. See how everybody's lunch was, wander around the office, right? Maybe around 2 o'clock, fire that thing back up, get some work done, right? Really working hard until, you know, maybe 3:30, and wonder how long they're going to expect me to stay today. Stop at the gas station on the way home, get a couple of tall boys. Oh, look, everybody's hanging out in the cul-de-sac tonight. Oh, perfect excuse. Maybe shut the thing down, pass out 2-3 in the morning, wake up at 8 o'clock, do it again. My employer would get a good solid 3 hours out of me, right? But yet, when I ask a guy to show up early to help me at a meeting or to go through the steps, man, I don't know, right? Hey, you think you could stay after for group conscience? Man, I got to get up early. Just a little bit. We don't need all of you, right? So, I have James wanted me to give him a signal when I only had 80 minutes left. This is the signal. I'm just kidding, of course. I'll only go, like, for another 60 minutes or so. I'm kidding. So, and how it works, right? So I'm fascinated how we attend so many meetings where we read how it works. Most of the AA meetings I attend, they read it at the beginning. Most people probably don't know that unless they're asked to read because, you know, they're busy on their phone or talking to their buddy or making eyes at the newcomer that just came in. But there's this line in the middle of how it works that it's fascinating to me that people miss it. So what's the point of the program, right? What's the point of everything? And it's hard to miss because it actually says, the point is... that we were willing to grow along spiritual lines, trick question. What's the point of the first step? To grow along spiritual lines. Second step? Same. Third step? Grow along spiritual lines. What's the point of the steps? To grow along spiritual lines. What's the point of existence? Yeah, you're cluing into it. This is how I choose to live my life, is to grow along spiritual lines. I don't view things as good or bad. I don't judge right and wrong from my experience. I've had enough experience in my life to know that if I'm willing to actually do this thing on a regular basis and seek this power, whatever it is, whatever you want to call it, my interaction with the universe, and do it on a regular basis and actually start to really gain access to that and concentrate, the thing that you will see and learn, or the thing that I've seen and I've learned, is that I kind of keep this little Rolodex of negative stuff that has happened to me in my life that I want to understand why it happened, right? And it's been my experience since I've been aware is that not a single one of those negative things that I ever experienced in my entire life has not come back to be useful to somebody else. You see, I was shown this early on, these ninth step promises. Maybe you guys have heard of them. They're at the end of the ninth step. They come as a result of working the ninth step. It says in there, it's this interesting line. We will not regret the past, nor will we wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. I'm not sure that I really believe that the first 172 times I heard these promises read. But I was given an experience about 6 months sober. There was a guy that he needed a place to stay so that he could get into a sober living on Monday, and because my wife had kicked me out and I was living alone, I actually had space, right? I didn't have to run it by anybody. And I didn't have the kids that weekend, so it was a real weird experience that I would love to tell you all the details about how God was working in every single moment of the weeks leading up to it, but I'll save you all that. But so this guy, I pick him up from the La Quinta off Holcomb Bridge in Atlanta, and I met like four other guys there. I mean, like, this guy was gonna get sober, right? They sent the whole army of people to help him, right? And they're cleaning all these liquor bottles out, and like, the guy's done, right? You look at him and he's done. Like, he doesn't smell like he's done, but he's done, right? And at the time, because I had accumulated some nice material things, I had a really nice car, and so got the okay from my network and sponsor and everybody that it was okay for this guy to come stay with me until Monday. So it's Saturday afternoon, and I pick him up. He gets in the passenger seat, and I don't know what I'm doing. I read Working with Others and got all the advice I could. I'm like, so I just start driving and start telling him my story, right? Start telling him about the fact that I went through 8 jobs in 6 years, how the fact that the wife left me, and I hardly get to see my 2 kids anymore, and how the failed business and the bankruptcy and all this junk, right? All this crap that I didn't think was worth anything to anybody. And I'm telling them the story, and I'm just blabbering on about all this stuff that happened to me. And I finish my story, but as I'm telling the story, he's like dipping lower and lower and lower into the passenger seat. And I'm like, I keep glancing over like, is he going to get sick on my floor? And I finished, and I said, okay, now you tell me your story. And he said, I don't have to. You just told it to me. My experience and his experience matched up almost exactly. I had a son and a daughter. He had two daughters. He had done pretty well for himself and burned it all to the ground. I did the same. And in that moment, I realized this. I had my sponsor and I've talked about this multiple times. I'm open up to the possibility that, wait a minute, maybe I'm useful. Maybe I'm useful to other people. Maybe all that stuff I went through was not a waste of energy, not a waste of time, right? And so regularly I get thrust in this experience where I get to see how the stuff that I went through that I didn't think would be worthwhile is useful to somebody else. And how I get to walk other people through whatever they're struggling with to open them up to the possibility that maybe it's happening for some reason that you don't understand. And so I ran a perfectly good marriage into the ground through drinking and doing what I did and just being a real big idiot, really. And she didn't deserve that. And the thing that I... The thing that there's a part of me that can never really fully get fixed, right? That part of me that knows that I made a commitment to this woman that I was going to be faithful and with her for the rest of my life, and I failed to uphold that. And so there's some things that happened in our relationship that I can't fully make right with her. But what God has done for me is generally newcomers. Right now it seems like people that have been through the steps wanting to go back through the steps is something that it's like I got a sign outside my office that says, "Hey, come rework the steps with Brandon," and people keep showing up. It's really weird. But when new guys, I get four different types of guys. Is either the guy's wife or significant other just kicked him out. His wife or significant other is getting ready to kick him out. His wife or significant other is getting ready to kick him out and he has no idea. Or he's incapable of relationships. And so what happens is that when I help these guys through their experience, is that little part of me that can't be fixed gets fixed. A little bit at a time. Slowly at first and then quickly. And you see, now I've got one of the greatest relationships that the world's ever seen, and I have one of the greatest lives that the world's ever seen for me, right? See, I have a life today that is the life I want. I have a relationship with my, the woman I'm married to now, where it's, every day's wonderful. Every day's magical. We're each other's best friends. We laugh. We talk. We do silly things like dress up like people from the 1920s and go tour the Biltmore, where I get to give her engagement ring back, new and improved. So imagine this with a cane and a bowler hat and a pocket watch. That's why I spent the money on the suit, is so that, you know, we'd look right together, right? You know, I still overdo some things. And so I get to have this experience in life where early in sobriety, it was very difficult for the mother of my children to have a conversation with me where she didn't, at some point in time in the conversation, tell me what was wrong with me. And one of those times she said, "Not only were you a terrible husband, you're a terrible father." Okay, two statements, terrible husband, terrible father. So let's look at them independently, okay? Am I a terrible husband? Well, at that time, she had the clearinghouse on Brandon, being married to Brandon. And, you know, I did a bunch of silly stuff, ruined the relationship, wrecked the family finances, put her through hell. I'm going to have to admit that one's true. Terrible husband. Okay, so what can I do about it? Well, with her, nothing, right? She stopped that opportunity. But what occurred to me is that if I ever get the opportunity to be a husband again, I need to be the best husband. Right? Strive for spiritual perfection. Right? If I'm aiming for perfection and I miss, I'm still going to be pretty good. If I'm aiming for pretty good and I miss, I might be drunk. And so I've embarked on a relationship with a woman where I try every day to be the best husband. It is my stated goal. It is the vision I've created in my life is to be the best husband. When the mother of my children said, "You're a terrible father," I looked at that experience. When I was drinking, yes, I did a bunch of stupid stuff, drove drunk with them in the car, would go get more to drink while they're in the bath. Just bad stuff, right? Terrible father when drinking, yes. Terrible father after I stopped drinking and worked the steps, not true. I even played Candyland with them. I hate that game. There's no strategy whatsoever. I cannot prove how smart I am, right? One red square, two red squares. Candy cane. But there was a point where I actually, she allowed me to make amends to her, that woman I was married to. And it was an emotional experience. She was very upset. She let me know. I was told that when you're making an amends, ask three questions. How did what I do make you feel? Have I done anything else that I'm unaware of that you would like to tell me about? And how do I make it right with you? How to amend, right? Not apologizing. I'm making right. And what she said was, stay sober for your kids. I left that amen going, sweet. That's all. Yes. You know, I didn't really realize the magnitude of that for some time afterwards. The mother of my children, I had to 12-step call her fiancé in the hospital. When he was getting belligerent and was threatening to come into the house and take some things back that she had paid for, she called me to come change the locks. When he insisted that he get paid for his portion of some furniture that they bought, I gave her the money to pay him off right there. You see, old me would have never done anything. Stuff. But new me, it's about making every situation right whenever I can, right? So she said, my the woman I'm married to now, she loves it when I pick up a baby chick at our farm, or when it's actually my idea for us to put on Christmas pajamas with the dog and take a picture. The same Christmas pajamas that the dog's wearing. Or that, like, when we're in Walmart for our new kitten that I'm putting the cat condo in the cart, you know. She loves the fact that I present like this big burly man, and yet I melt pretty easy. So, you want to see me melt? So, when the mother of my children said, stay sober for your kids, I didn't know what that really meant or how big of a deal that really was. See, I got a daughter. She's 15 now, and she gets to share with me a bunch of experiences that she's going through that are confusing to a 15-year-old girl, right? And I get to be present for that. And she gets to tell me honestly how she's feeling about certain things that, that she would not care to have repeated about other people, right? And so naturally, she and I, every Monday, we go to dinner together. And I drive her to dance. And we have a date. And in the beginning, I thought it was just I was driving her to dance. But it's something that she looks forward to. It's something that I look forward to every week, every chance we get. And so naturally, she questioned her mom one time about, you know, Dad's pretty awesome. Why did you decide to kick him out, right? And the mother of my children said this to her. She said that the man that your dad is today is not the man that I was married to. And then I get letters like this. Dear Dad, happy birthday. I love you so, much. And I'm so grateful you are my dad. You teach me something new every day. And you make me feel so loved. Every week when we go to dinner, I get so excited because of the time we get to spend together. I love spending time with you. And I love all our conversations that come from going with it, along with them. I'm so grateful for the life that you've helped Mom make for my brother and I. You've taught me so much about life that helps me prepare for what is to come. You have showed me strength, love, and perseverance through everything you do. I love spending time with you so much, whether it's car rides, sitting on the couch, going to the grocery store, or going to dinner or cooking in the kitchen. You unknowingly, or maybe you do know, that you are making me so strong. But mostly, you make me feel appreciated. You do some of the smallest things, like you sending me those cheesy Bitmojis or getting me cookies and cream Hershey's bars. It just makes me feel important, which means a lot. I love how you set aside time every week to eat dinner with me, or how you call me after every dance weekend. I love how you show up to every performance with flowers, or how you always write on my birthday card in a cool way with my name. There are so many things that I love about you and I appreciate you for. But I mostly wanted to say I love you and I hope you have an amazing birthday. Now, one of the things that she references in that is bringing her flowers to her dance performances. And you see, I've had to guide the mother of my children and my daughter through how to comfort the family of an alcoholic who drank himself to death. When they're driving over to my daughter's friend's house because the night before her friend's dad drank himself to death. You know what I mean? Us alcoholics, we can't even die right. Right? He called like 29 times that night. And so now the family's left with this idea that if they would have answered one of those calls, maybe we'd still be alive. The guilt that they're going to suffer through for the rest of their life just because what if I would have answered? And I got to advise her how to be a friend, how to sit through that experience. And my sponsor and I were doing a workshop weekend and I got this text from my daughter. She had gone to the beach with her friend and her friend's family. And she said, I just wanted to text you and say that I'm so grateful you got sober. I just had to watch Anna, Lisa, and Lily spread Scott's ashes, and it was the most awful thing. I love you so much, and I appreciate you more than you will ever know. You see, you want to change the world? Get sober. You want to keep on wrecking the world? Keep going. But I'll tell you what. Life, for me, is really fucking awesome since I got sober. And the greatest and most exciting part of my life is the part that started on June 15th, 2011 until now. So thanks for letting me share.
Give me and Brandon just a second to come down there, and we'll close this thing with the Lord's Prayer.